Today is Labor Day, isn't it? I thought I would give a talk on labor, on work. This is an area which sooner or later seems to interest a lot of people who do mindfulness meditation, the topic of how to integrate their practice into their work life. Since for many people, a big chunk of their day is spent at work. The idea to how to bring mindfulness, presence, concentration, clarity, compassion into this very important area also. And how to let work be a foundation that supports cultivation of spiritual life. So some people feel like the two are sometimes opposed. There's a spiritual development qualities in life, and there's a work life. And it doesn't make sense to compartmentalize a life if we're living a spiritual life. So then how do we bring in, how do we engage with work as a spiritual discipline or as a support for our spiritual discipline? How do we bring mindfulness to work? So it's a very important topic. It's a huge topic, many areas to explore. One of the important things perhaps to say to begin is that if you want to integrate your mindfulness practice into work, it helps if you have a mindfulness practice to integrate. meaning that I know some people who hear these wonderful ideas of teachings of being mindful and present, and like, well, I'll just kind of, like by magic, somehow I'll just go and do it in the most difficult places of my life, and somehow it'll happen. And you need to cultivate the foundation of regular practice that then somehow somehow that spills over, or by osmosis carries over, or inspires you, prepares you for more difficult areas of life. So if you have a regular daily sitting practice, for example in the morning, then it makes sense to explore, well, how can I bring some of that presence and clarity into my work life? And then you're doing the kind of preparation ahead of time, in a sense, and then you bring that to work. And that helps a lot. I mean, if you're not doing at least that, mindfulness is always beneficial, but you're really kind of shortchanging yourself. One of the powerful, powerful foundations that will really help this whole process move forward. Also, what I've noticed is that some people feel that since they're mindfulness practitioners, that it's all about let's try to bring more mindfulness to work. That's all they need to do. Let's how to be more attentive, more present, less distracted at work. And so they'll cultivate all kinds of wonderful tricks to try to remind them to be mindful through the day. Wonderful tricks. These are the kind of things I often teach in the introductory course, of the last day of the introductory course, is simple kind of tricks to help you be mindful through the day. And common one I often talk about is walking through door frames. Whenever I walk through a door, it used to be a very common practice of mine, I would use that as a transition point, as a moment to kind of pay attention to what was happening in the moment, what I was feeling, where I was walking into, what I'd left, kind of a moment to kind of recollect myself and be present. Some people will use a telephone ringing. They want to answer the first ring, but they answer maybe the third or fourth or fifth ring. And just use that time while listening to the ringing as a way to breathe and be present and recollect themselves. I've heard people who've used little stickers, and they put little stickers in different places in their office or in their place of work. And then periodically, as they come across one of these little stickers, they will be mindful of what's going on, or they'll breathe for a few moments or whatever. There's many little things people do to help them be mindful throughout the day at work. But to integrate mindfulness or spiritual life into our work, there needs to be much greater consideration of what we're doing than simply bringing mindfulness and presence to our activity. And one of the ways to look at it is to look at the way the Buddha laid out the spiritual training, the spiritual development. And he talked about virtue as being the foundation of the spiritual path. And then he talked about relaxation, concentration, calm as being the second foundation, and that insight and wisdom being a third. And so it's kind of like a pyramid, or maybe a triangle, you need to have a very strong base for that triangle to be stable. And the strong base is a base of virtue. And then there's the base of relaxation and calm. And then there's the pinnacle of Buddhist practice is the development of insight and compassion. And so many people will try to bring the insight, the mindfulness, to their work life without reflecting very much about the foundations of virtue or the foundations of relaxation. And it behooves us, I think, to look at this a little bit. And if we're serious about bringing mindfulness to work, it's very important to spend some time reflecting on the nature of your work and the nature of how you want to be involved with work. And not just to take it for granted, not just think it's just about, mindfulness is this kind of magic, pill that you just take this pill of mindfulness and everything else will be fine. But it's really useful to spend some time looking at all various issues around work. One of the issues is this really what you want to be doing? Another issue is, what do you really want to do? Another issue might be, what is the attitude you want to bring to work? What are you really doing when you go to work? Are you simply making money? The faster you can make money, the better the work is. Or are there other values and other attitudes, other things that are important for you while you do the work? The Buddha said that it was very useful he said it was one of the forms of happiness is to have financial security. And the Buddha encouraged people to help for lay people. He said one of the things that brings happiness to lay people is if they work earnestly, energetically, and skillfully, develop a skill, they develop some knowledge about what they're doing, and they engage themselves with energy and earnest in their work. Part because that brings pleasure in and of itself, but also because that's a condition for hopefully some kind of financial security, which the Buddha called one of the four forms of lay happiness, happiness for lay people. But what is our work about? If that's all it's about, then maybe we're not really giving ourselves a full chance to let work be a place that we cultivate our heart, to cultivate deeper aspects of who we are. What does it take to so that work is a place where we're wholeheartedly engaged in? And wholeheartedly, I think, is a wonderful expression, because to be wholehearted means not to be divided. It means to have a good heart. It means to have a sense of the goodness of who we are, not to be protected or not to be adversarial with the world. But a good heart, I think, is a heart which is concerned with our own welfare and the welfare of the people around us. And does our work express that good-heartedness, full-heartedness, wholeheartedness, engagement in what we're doing? And if we're just doing work because it's a convenient place to make money, then I don't think we bring our wholeheartedness to it. Our love, our dedication, our sense of purpose and sense of value, or what's really most valuable for us in our life. I know there are some people who will never find the one thing for work, which is like their vocation or the right thing that they're, finding the right work is not so important for them. Rather, for some people, what's all important is the way they do the work, the how of the work, not what they do, but the how they do it. Do they do it with care? Do they do it with love? Do they do it with a sense of community and sense of connectedness with the people around them, the co-workers or the community? There are many values that can go into our work life. And do we spend time thinking about that, reflecting on it, and then looking at our work life and saying, does it really measure up to the values and attitudes that I want to live by? And what are the intentions that I want to live by in relationship to my work? That kind of reflection is phenomenally important and useful. And that's maybe the broadest base foundation of making work into a meaningful spiritual arena. The second base, then, is the base of virtue. Is the work we're doing virtuous? Does it express our good heart, our sense of care and connectedness to the people around us and to ourselves? Does it express our good intentions, or does it express our unwholesome intentions? There's plenty of people who intention around work is to basically take advantage of other people, somehow get the better of other people, trick them. I've had salesmen, salespeople, who I did not think they had my good, my best wishes in mind when they were trying to, you know, get their best price out of me. And I think there's very easy in the world of business and world of work, especially if a person is involved in sales, for unethical activity. And do we want to live? Do we want to be involved in activity which is unethical? And there's a whole range of stuff. So the Buddha was actually one of the places the Buddha was very, very firm and very clear about what he felt was prohibitive, was when he said what kind of livelihood a person should absolutely not be engaged in. If you're involved in a spiritual path, you should not be involved in the sale, probably the manufacture and the sale of weapons. You should not be involved in the manufacture and sale of alcohol and drugs, I suppose, intoxicating drugs. You should not be involved in commerce that has to do with human beings. So prostitution or slavery or things like that. And he was quite firm about that. Remember Usilananda, who's this wonderful Burmese teacher who lives in Half Moon Bay. I was at a conference with him, Buddhist conference, exploring the topic of, well, basically of ethics, Buddhist ethics. And different teachers were speaking. And at some point, there was a panel, and the teachers on the panel were asked, as a Buddhist teacher, what's the most challenging ethical issue you have? So that was, you know, got people's attention. Now they're going to hear something great and juicy. And what he said was that as a monk who ministers the Burmese community in the Bay Area, he knows how incredibly difficult it is back then, 10 years ago, how difficult it was for the Burmese immigrants to find work and support sometimes extended families. And some of them would find work in factories in the Bay Area that produced weapons, made missiles or tanks or various things that we make around here in the Bay Area. And they would come to him and ask him, is this right livelihood? And his biggest ethical dilemma as a teacher was what to say to them. Because he knew that that was unethical for them to be involved in there, in that kind of occupation. But he also knew how hard it was for them to find work. And so he didn't want to tell them it's unethical because that would make it really difficult for them to support their families. But he also didn't want to say it was ethical. So he never told us what he did say. But this is where he found himself kind of struggling with this ethical dilemma. But is the work we do ethical? Is the way we engage in the work ethical? And is the way we relate to the people at our place of work ethical, to express our virtue? And that's a useful area of exploration, not in the moralistic sense, in order to be, you know, get heavy and depressed about it, but rather as a way of clarifying, again, what our deepest values are, and to live from what's really important. It's impossible to develop spiritually from a Buddhist point of view if you're intentionally harming other people or taking advantage of them. And it's a very simple reason for that, and that is spiritual development in Buddhism is to let go, give up, cleanse oneself of greed, hate, and delusion. And if you're acting on greed, hate, and delusion, you can't exactly think, you know, you're not cleansing it then. So if you want to, so if we try at least to try to clean up our behavior, our actions, so that our actions don't express greed, hate, and delusion. It's a lot more difficult, of course, to clean up our minds or our hearts. These things pop up all the time. But at least we monitor our life well enough that we're not going to actively do this. We're not going to act on the impulses of greed and hate in unethical ways. And this provides a very wonderful foundation for work. It makes work a place, for some people, just that reflection at work, how to be ethical, how to treat the people around me ethically, is a very powerful, for some people, a very powerful mindfulness practice in and of itself. Sometimes there's many opportunities, especially if you're involved in, you know, meetings a lot. how to treat each other at the meetings with respect and kindness. So that's just the ethical foundation is very useful just for developing mindfulness. It also helps make the work environment a place where we can enter the work environment feeling faultless. We don't feel like we have to be ashamed of ourselves or hide anything. We can kind of take refuge, in a sense, in knowing that our intention and our actions are virtuous. So I lived at Tassajara for a long time. It was a Zen monastery in the Big Sur. And I was kind of amazed when I was working there during the summers. A lot of people would come down to be guests. And regularly there would be people who had owned businesses up here in the Bay Area who would make announcements or put up signs in the bulletin board down there saying, if there are any Tassajara residents who want a job when they leave Tassajara, call me up. I have a restaurant, I have a hotel, I have whatever. And so I asked some of these people, I thought it was kind of strange at first. Why are you doing this? And their answer was, I'm actually having a hard time finding people that I could trust. And I trust that the people who've been through the spiritual training at Tassajara for a number of years, that there are good chances they're really trustable people. And so I'll take the chance. I want to hire those people. I want to find more people like that to have in my business. So again, partly what I'm talking about here is a reflective practice, to reflect on our intentions and attitudes, and then to reflect on our virtue and our ethics. What actually motivates a day-to-day behavior? Is it virtuous? Do we want it to be virtuous? Do we understand how virtue is a foundation for the development of presence? The next important thing is concentration. Another way of talking about this in the relationship to work is relaxation. One of the foundations of mindfulness is to be relaxed. And it's very hard to be mindful if you're not somewhat relaxed. And what this means for me is that if you want your work to be a place where you develop mindfulness, a place of spiritual practice, you want to try to prepare yourself for going to work. You want to prepare yourself for the kind of work you're going to do, if you can. And you want to try to kind of create the conditions so you can go to work somewhat relaxed and not tense. One of the ways is to sit in the morning. For many people, that helps a lot. Another way, perhaps, is to get enough sleep or to exercise. But to expect you can kind of barrel ahead with your life in whatever way you want, and then just add a little bit of mindfulness, like a little bit of salt, and then everything will be fine. But actually look and study your life, your daily life, and are there ways that you can change it to support your spiritual practice if that's important enough for you? And one of the ways is to prepare yourself for work. And one of the ways to prepare yourself to work is to arrive at work somewhat relaxed and at ease. And if you're relaxed, you're setting up the conditions to make it a lot easier to be mindful through the day. Preparing for work also means preparing for the particular different tasks you have at work. And I find it very useful when I'm going to transition from one task to the next to stop what I'm doing for a few minutes, 2, 3, 4, 5 minutes, sometimes very short, but to stop what I'm doing and just sit and look out a window or look out the door where I live go for a little walk or just have a cup of tea or something. Because if I rush from one thing to the next, which is often a tendency for people, then I tend to wind myself up. And the more wound up I get, the more difficult it is to be present and mindful and to live the kind of life that I want to live. So taking little breaks periodically is a way of preparing myself for the next task, letting myself unwind, to allow some kind of relaxation to be part of the day. To monitor your stress level, to monitor how wound up you are. And again, I find reflection to be very useful around the issue of being wound up or being stressed out at work. To use, when you feel stressed at work, to stop and reflect, what is it that's really important for you? Is it really this how you want to live your life? Is what you're pursuing in being stressed really worth the sacrifice that it's costing you? And I think stress, usually when we're engaged in too much work, running around, and we tend to lose touch with ourselves in the process of getting increasingly wound up. And is that something we want to do? So again, this area of reflection is so important part of a spiritual life, to reflect and to contemplate, to think about the attitudes and values that we have and how we want to express them in our lives. Another thing that the Buddha emphasized a lot, both for just spiritual life, but also for lay happiness, and another area of when the Buddha gave teachings about how to support happiness in the lay life, he stressed the value of friendship. And in relationship to work, this means what kind of relationships do you have between people in your place of work? Are there friendships there? I know a few people who have colleagues at work who are also meditators. And they report how useful that is because both of them are engaged in trying to be mindful. And they can talk about that a little bit, or they can kind of support each other in that endeavor. I know some places of work where there's two or three or four people who meditate, and they'll meet at lunchtime for 20 minutes or 30 minutes or whatever. And I know one person I knew, the only place in the place of business that was quiet and suitable for this was a closet, a big closet. So they would get in the closet and they'd move the boxes around, you know, and then they would sit on the floor and they'd meditate. And then hopefully no one came to get supplies. But the Buddha, in emphasizing friendship, wasn't just simply emphasizing, you know, that close spiritual friends, but also that there's a feeling of friendliness around the people we work with. If there is no cultivation of friendliness, no field of friendliness around us, it's going to be a lot harder for our wholehearted goodness, our wholehearted engagement in our spiritual development, our mindfulness, to come to the foreground. If we're not in a friendly environment, then we're going to be in an environment probably where we're protective or aggressive or defensive or something. Can we cultivate friendships? Friendliness. I remember when I worked I worked at Green's Restaurant, which was a kind of very fast-paced, wasn't exactly fast food, but it was kind of known as a kind of gourmet vegetarian restaurant, but you wouldn't, you know, in the kitchen it felt pretty fast. And in other words, sometimes I made it so I was a kind of one of the cooks, and I had to deliver a lot of food really quickly to all these waiters and waitresses that come by, and the other cooks in the fast food line that we had to work together with. And sometimes I would make it my task for the day to try to have a friendly interaction with every person that I had come contact with. So mostly people would run in and grab the plate of food, the pasta, and run out without even looking at me. And I would try to see, could I have a friendly contact with each of those people? And sometimes they wouldn't even notice I existed. They just wanted the pasta. But at least, could I at least put the pasta down on the counter in such a way that was easier for them to get to? So I was always kind of thinking about, how could I make it easier for them? How could I connect with them? How can I have a friendly conversation with them? And sometimes I'd have these running conversations with people. They'd come in, and they'd be there for 30 seconds, and I would ask them about something or talk about something. And then I kept in mind the conversations, because they'd be back 10 minutes later and pick up the conversation. And I tried to make a friendly work environment for people, for myself. The cultivation of friendships. And I think this is really central to a spiritual life, I think, because if our spiritual life doesn't also occur in relationship to the people around us, then I suspect that it's not a spiritual life. And then maybe it's just self-serving for the most part, especially if it's in the work environment. Something else that I find valuable is silence. Periods of silence while we work. And I love silence a lot. It's actually my preference. It's odd. Sometimes I think it's very odd that I ended up in this line of work. where I do so much talking, because I actually prefer not to talk. And but to actually give ourselves some chance to work in silence. Some people that means turning off a radio. Sometimes it means not to engage in conversations as we work. And this is something I learned in the Zen monasteries, where there was a strong etiquette, strong kind of, actually there was a rule sometimes that you weren't supposed to talk while you worked. And so we would work in silence unless we had to talk about the work. We wouldn't be talking about anything else, but if we weren't talking about the work, we would be working silently side by side if we were working together. I remember once going to talk to the cook, and I think I was just going to go chat. I wasn't working, so it seemed okay to talk. And as I showed up, and the cook was chopping vegetables, and I started talking to the cook, and I asked some question or something, and then the cook put the knife down, faced me, and responded. Very nice. So then I continued. He picked up his knife, started chopping. And then it was his turn to have, you know, to respond to me again. So he put down his knife, looked at me, and responded to me directly. And then I continued talking. And then and the third time he put down his knife and he said, you know, it's very hard for me to do my work if you're going to talk to me. Because what I try to do is really be involved with one thing at a time. And I'm not going to be chopping vegetables and talking to you at the same time. So either I'm going to talk to you or I'm going to chop vegetables. It's my job right now to chop vegetables, and that's what I'm going to do. And he was taking this as a place to develop his concentration and mindfulness, to really fully be engaged in a silent way on the work he was doing. And to spend some time like that. If we're too defensive about our silence, that becomes problematic too. But I find it very valuable to spend some time in silence. Some people spend a lot of time in silence, them and the keyboard. And maybe then we have to find intentional ways not to be in silence all the time, but to break the monotony and the addiction sometimes, the numbness that can set in if we're kind of endlessly kind of alone all the time. And it's very important to get up and walk around and talk to some other people. That's probably enough. I can do this. I mean, it's an endless topic, right? Probably, but kind of to repeat what I've said so many times now already. I think part of a mindful life is to have a reflective life, and to spend some time reflecting about what are the values and intentions that we want to bring to the various aspects of our life. And one of the areas of our life to reflect on is our work life, and not to take it for granted. But actually to maybe insist that our work area, the time we spend in work, is somehow deeply meaningful for not just our pocketbook and our status, but deeply meaningful for our heart, so that our good-heartedness, our whole-heartedness, our full-heartedness has a chance to grow and develop and spill over and benefit the community around us. So it's very odd that the day we celebrate labor, we don't go to work. It should be a work day, and we just go to work differently. Wouldn't that be something? If we declared a holiday and everybody had to go to work, but the law was you had to work in a new way. You had to work quietly, silently, or friendlily, or just... Anyway. Any comments or questions? Yes.
Well, what this brought up for me, I know there's one of my coworkers has this little statue of Buddha on his desk. He shared with me the Dhammapada once. It's a version that has like these elaborate illustrations, you know. It's like the words are almost secondary. But maybe that's just my judgmental mind going. But I just thought that it might be nice to propose a 5-minute segment of the day that we would sit and just read that together and perhaps find other Buddhist practitioners around.
Sounds great. Sounds great. So some people, what I know most commonly is people will arrange to meditate together. Having some little study group or a little reading thing would be great. Yes?
Well, I used to work for a corporation a long time ago, and the hardest thing for me was, in thinking back about it, I didn't put it in these terms at the time, but thinking back about it was that I was in sales and marketing, and my role was to create attachment. And, and it was a difficult thing to for me to do, and because the worst thing for me was at the end of every month, by the 25th of every month, the CEO would come in and say, "Oh, it's the 25th of the month. What are sales this month? Oh, you're only at 70% of target. Well, what are your plans for the evenings between now?" So I don't know. It's frustrating to think about because it seems like our whole capitalist system is built on attachment. It's like that's the foundation of it. So I guess it's just something to be mindful of.
Well, there's certainly things to reflect on. That's for sure. And so exactly what areas we want to question or what areas we are supporting. That's very much a personal issue, but. But I think, yes?
I'm wondering about people who are in the service.
Service?
Yeah, war.
Oh, military services, like here.
And I'm familiar with, in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna's advice to Arjuna, that you have to do your job. And that if he would bring death to anybody, that person was going to die anyway. Because life is impermanent. But how is this approached in Buddhism? People are drafted and in time of war. And what advice does Buddhism give to people who have been hired to be soldiers?
Well, I think in the history of Buddhism you find every variety of advice given. You have hawkish Buddhist teachers who have given very hawkish advice. There was a monk in Thailand, a very famous monk in Thailand, who was really inspiring the military to go out there and kill the communists, because killing a communist was good for Buddhism. And then you have monks who are radical pacifists, you know, and who actually will have nothing to do with military and feel it's, you know, so you find the whole range. So you can't just say this is what Buddhism says. It's a little bit hard because you find historically quite a range. Buddhism, as some other Indian religions, puts a tremendous emphasis on ahimsa, which is usually sometimes translated as non-violence, non-harming. And the first precept for laity is not to harm, not to kill. Then the question is how strictly you want to interpret that. And for those people who interpret it strictly, they'll not have anything to do with military at all. And and for monastics, there's a whole series of very strict rules about monastics not being involved in anything to do with military or get close to a battle or give military advice or political advice or anything. They really stay away from that whole world. But you're finding different Buddhists will interpret that differently. My personal kind of interpretation of Buddhism, where I live by it, is I'm a pacifist. I would not have served in the military. If I'd been drafted during the Vietnam War, which was a possibility, I wouldn't have gone. I would have been a conscientious objector. So that's my kind of, you know, I'm not of the hawkish type. So it's probably not very satisfying to give that kind of answer to you, but that's historically is the case. You find a wide range of what Buddhists will say. And I could tell you what I think the Buddha believed, but everybody, that's what all Buddhists claim. Yes?
Are the virtues for laymen different than for monks? When you talk about happiness as being a primary thing, how can it be different from liberation?
Yes, there's a tendency in Buddhism to see that the goal of the life is different for laity and for monastics. There's not a hard and fast rule, and here in the modern world, it's changed quite dramatically. We have a lot of lay people pursuing liberation and freedom in a very serious way. But historically, in ancient times, and some degree still in traditional Southeast Asia, it was understood that to pursue enlightenment was a very kind of full-time endeavor, kind of something you had to kind of engage a lot of time with. And if you were busy with the demands of work and the demands of raising a family, it didn't give you the kind of time, serious time, that it took to be engaged in the path of liberation. And so what lay people mostly were pursuing was how to be happy. And so there was this path of happiness and the path of liberation. And so the Buddha gave advice on how to cultivate happiness for lay people and how to cultivate liberation for people who were more serious about, not even more serious, but that chose that option for liberation. And what's happened in the modern world, first in Southeast Asia and now in America also, is you find the path of liberation really opened up to the laity in a full-fledged way. But and the path and mindfulness practice and mindfulness meditation belongs to the path of liberation. That's historically what it belongs in. And but a lot of people in the West don't use it for that. They've actually use it for the path of happiness. Nothing wrong with that, but that's what it gets appropriated for, what people want to use it for. So for example, when people just use it for stress reduction, I would say that's really the path of happiness, not the path of liberation. Steve?
You mentioned four joys or something for laity. One of them was work. What are the other three?
There's a number of lists, but the one list is the four kind of happinesses of a layperson. One is financial security. The other is to be out of debt. Same thing. And the third is having the opportunity to use your wealth, your money, wisely. Use it for yourself, for your family, for your community, for acts of generosity and charity. To use it wisely in all those ways is a. And in this particular list, and the fourth one, is to have I think it's a true and virtuous heart. And then what's interesting is the Buddha said that the happiness of security, of being out of debt, and being able to use your money wisely, is not worth 1/16th the part of the happiness that comes from having a virtuous heart. So, if you want to kind of cultivate happiness, you should give 16 parts or emphasis on your virtue, and one part emphasis on the other things. Divide it up that way. Yes, please.
When you talk about reflecting, is that different from normal thinking?
It doesn't.
Special qualities to what do you mean by?
I don't know what your normal thinking is like. But it's maybe not so different.
The monkey mind.
Yeah, no, it's not the monkey mind. It's actually to give more contemplation, to give some more serious directed thinking about something, to keep focused and you know, to hold a theme, a certain consideration for a while. Just think about that. Not just to kind of think randomly and let it drift in and out as you wish. Kind of the way you'd have if you have a serious conversation with someone on a particular topic, you stay focused. So you do the same thing for yourself. Just stay focused on that topic for a while and reflect on it. It helps to get calm and concentrated. So to do something that makes you really relaxed and concentrated, so you can use that concentration to stay present for your theme, makes often the work much more creative.
Does it also include an absence of drivenness in finding an answer to the problem?
Oh, that helps a lot, yeah. If there's compulsion involved, then it's hard to think clearly. So one of the times I find myself thinking most clearly, for example, is if I go for a walk or a run or something like that. Because I try not to think when I meditate. But I love going for a run. Like this afternoon, I went for a run. And it kind of is a way of kind of loosening up my thinking, so that it becomes actually much more creative. And part of what's happening when I'm running is I'm not trying to get an answer. I'm not trying to figure something out. I'm just letting the reflection kind of percolate on its own. Yes, Smita.
You said inside meditation was the way to liberation.
Yes.
So was there a traditional way to achieve happiness? Was it a different kind of practice, or it was just bringing mindfulness to everyday?
Oh, the traditional teachings on happiness are cultivate virtue, practice generosity, and then you know, try to develop some financial security. The Buddha said financial security is one of the conditions for happiness.
So really, traditionally, meditation is not suggested at all?
Meditation was traditionally something that was reserved for people who are kind of more engaged full-time in a spiritual life. It's hard for me to know, but I mean, there certainly were, in the time of the Buddha, laity who were involved seriously in practice and who had high attainments as practitioners. And probably down through the centuries, there's always been a certain percentage of lay Buddhists who were involved in meditation practice. But it changed dramatically about 60 years ago, 50, 60 years ago. Well, 100 years ago in Sri Lanka, there was a big upswelling of lay Buddhism, and there was a lot of all kinds of lay Buddhist activity going on, and lay Buddhists felt really empowered, and it was in reaction to the Christian missionaries, and as a way of kind of regaining respect for Buddhism and they saw there was the YMCA, so they developed the YMBA, you know, and all kinds of these lay associations. But there was a lot of serious endeavor in Sri Lanka. And then about 50, 60 years ago, in Burma, there was the opening of the doors to the laity, and they started building and open meditation monasteries that were not monasteries, meditation centers. Where laity can go practice. And this was a rather kind of new and revolutionary thing. And from Burma, it spread into Thailand. And also then in the 1950s, it spread into Sri Lanka. And now you have in these countries a lot of different meditation centers where lay people will go there. One of the inspiring things when I was in Burma, there was kind of like around some springtime, there was this holiday time, like we have Easter, I guess it lasted for a week or two. And the monastery, which I think normally had maybe 800 people living in it, swelled to about 5,000. And there were all these lay people who came to do a week or 2 weeks of intensive meditation. That's what they did during the holidays. Yes?
I read somewhere that for back into the last century that it was a practice for young men in Southeast Asia to go into the monasteries for 2 years, and they weren't considered socially polished until they had done that. And a lot of, from what I read, a lot of prospective brides would not consider a man unless he'd spent his 2 years in a monastery. Have you read anything about that? Or?
I don't know historically how it was, but I do know in Thailand, a lot of young men will go spend time as a monk in the monastic life when they're maybe 20 or so. And actually, I'm told that in Thailand, they have civil servants in Thailand will be given, once a lifetime, they're given a leave of absence from their job so they can go spend 3 months as a monk. And usually not 2 years, usually 3 months.
Well, I was reading this in context of the king who was Anna and the king of Siam, apparently before his brother was the king and he was a monk.
For many, many years.
Yeah, and was called back. And that was what the context of the article I was reading.
Yeah, I think he had no intention of being a king. He was for many, many years a very important monk. And but it's very common in Thailand for young men to go spend some time, and also young women spend some time in the monasteries. And there is some aspect of that the young women go spend some time in the monastery so they can find the young men who are getting their religious training, because supposedly they make better husbands then.
On this topic of late Buddhism, Mel and I just got back from Bhutan, which is an extension, and I was very, very happy to go to a Tibetan country. And it's totally, to a Buddhist country, it's totally Buddhist. But I kept looking for the points of practice of the lay people, and it's meditation is not like one of their practices. Their main practice is supporting the monks. Well, they're many things, but meditation is not even daily or weekly or daytime. It's not one of the things which is part of their.
It's a pioneering thing we're doing here in Palo Alto in many ways. And maybe we don't realize it. We kind of take it for granted, perhaps, just the opportunity to do what we're doing and doing what we're doing. But it's really a pioneering thing to figure out how to offer a very, very, very powerful spiritual practice in the context of lay life, work life, family life, and hopefully in a way that that is powerfully effective and can be used as support for people to cultivate qualities of awakening and liberation. In some sense, this whole lay-centered movement in the West of people engaged in mindfulness practice has never been seen in Buddhism before. So how we're creating it here in the West is we're kind of pioneers in figuring out how to do it and what to do. So it's a wonderful thing, and I hope those of you who are serious about it will stay serious. So, thank you all very much.